The Guardian.
Welcome to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, my guests are linked by tall ships, desert islands, and stormy waters. I'll be swashbuckling with Gore Verbinski, director of three of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, who'll be talking about his new animated movie, Rango, starring Johnny Depp as a chameleon. I'll be meeting National Treasure Dame Helen Mirren, taking on one of Shakespeare's most famous male roles, playing Prospera in a new film version of The Tempest. Plus, our resident barometer of movie quality, Zan Brooks, will be joining me in studio to review this week's hot releases, including Client 9, a documentary about a prostitute bringing down the governor of New York, and The Adjustment Bureau, starring Emily Blunt and Matt Damon. We'll also look at a British film in the European style, Archipelago. So, all aboard me hearties, set sail, it's Film Weekly. Helen Mirren began her career on the stage, joining the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1966. Since then, she has catapulted onto our screens, first via TV, then film, bagging herself an Oscar, four BAFTAs, three Golden Globes, and a damehood along the way. But now she's come full circle, combining her Hollywood prowess with her Shakespearean roots, playing Prospera, a female version of Prospero, the exiled sorcerer stranded on a deserted island, in a US-made film of Shakespeare's final play, The Tempest. It was filmed in Hawaii and also stars Russell Brand, Felicity Jones and David Strathairn. I went to meet Dame Helen Mirren and began by asking her what convinced her that Prospero was ready to become Prospera.
Well, it was a kind of a theory in the back of my mind when I was watching it a while ago in a very good production with Derek Jacobi. And, you know, I've done a lot of Shakespeare in my time, but as you get older, the roles kind of get less and less, or less and less interesting anyway. So watching the play, I had thought, you know, that could be done by a woman. And you
does Derek Jacobi
to...
know that his performance as Prosper inspired,
inspired
me
to be
a woman doing
this? I don't know if he does, actually. I don't, maybe, I hope he'd be pleased with that thought.
Dost thou forget from what a torment I did free thee?
No.
I must once in a month recount what thou hast been which thou forgetst. This damned witch Sycorax, for mischiefs manifold and sorceries terrible to enter human hearing, from Algiers thou knowest was banished. Is not this true?
Aye, ma'am.
Blue-eyed hag was hither brought with child, and here was left by the sailors. Thou, my slave, as thou reports thyself, was then her servant. But for thou wast a spirit too delicate to act her earthy and abhorred commands, she did confine thee into a cloven pine, within which rift imprisoned, thou didst painfully remain a dozen years, within which space she died and left thee there. Thou best knowest what a torment I did find thee in. Thy groans did make wolves howl.
I thought of doing it on the stage. I never thought of doing it in the on a film. But when Julie had the same idea... Julie Taymor had the same idea. And suddenly we were up and running and she found the financing for it. And it absolutely blew me away that it was going to be a film. And then I got really cold feet because I thought, my God, you know, you can, in the theatre, if you bomb and it's a terrible mistake, it goes away and everyone forgets about it. At film, it's there for all time.
Because there are some fantastically famous female performances of male roles in Hamlet. I'm going all the way back to Sarah Byrne.
Yes,
part.
Indeed. Yes, of course.
Were you aware
but not
of
often
that?
As, you know, you couldn't do Hamlet as a woman, Hamletta. You couldn't do that. Everything would be, you know, it would shift. You'd have to twist the play
yes.
so seriously. It would just wouldn't work. Whereas The Tempest does work with a woman playing the role. I can't think of another Shakespearean play where that is the case, quite honestly.
Hast thou, spirit, performed to the point The Tempest that I bade thee?
I boarded the king's ship.
In every cabin I flamed amazement. Even to roaring.
Over the years, have you often thought while you were playing your part and sort of, I don't know, say opposite Bob Hoskins in Long Good Friday, thinking, God, I wish I could be that Lee, that Harold Shannon.
Of course. You think that all the time as a woman, especially when I was younger, because, you know, the female roles when I was younger. Mind you, I think it's always the way when you're younger. You know, you play these awful sort of ciphers. It's interesting, Felicity, who's so fantastic as Miranda.
Felicity Jones, yeah.
She's brilliant as Miranda.
At first sight, they have changed eyes.
Do you love me?
Beyond all limit.
They are both in either's power.
But she said, I'm dying to play a role where I don't have to cry. She said, I have to cry in every single role. And that's the trouble with being a young actress. You know, you're always snivelling in a corner somewhere. And it's really annoying and you want to get out of that.
Mm.
Yes, of course, absolutely.
I mean, I think that's a really interesting thing that there's the line from Prosperity, her, my foot, my tutor. In a way, you do teach her stuff. Have you found yourself kind of imparting some kind of wisdom to Felicity Jones, who is a terrific young actress, I think?
I didn't feel that I needed to at all. I thought she was so brilliant with the language. She at the same time has the ability to express true emotion through the language, and that's a rare, you know, very rare thing. She, if anything, I was watching her going, oh my God, you're really, really good. You know, what can I learn from you? That's the fun about my profession, is you're always looking at, you recognise really brilliant people and you learn from them.
Well, these young actresses, Felicity, Kenny Ryder, do you give them some advice? I mean, would they ask for advice?
No, only if they ask. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And sometimes they do ask. And, you know, sometimes it's not so much to do with, how to act a scene or, you know, how to say a line, but it's what should I do next?
Yeah.
The kind of career advice. It's always a bit dangerous to impart career advice, but, you know, if I'm asked, I'll say I will, you know, give them what I know of the decisions, the choices you have to make.
And would it be to brush up your Shakespeare?
Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's, no, move away from Shakespeare. Now's the time to do movies. And I felt that with Felicity, for example. You know, it was time for her to move into movies, I thought.
Brilliant. Well, I wouldn't have guessed that the next thing you would be doing would be seeing Russell Brand again doing Arthur
as
well.
That's right. Yeah.
That's done now. We'll see you in Arthur.
Yeah, in April, yeah.
Isn't that funny?
I don't know. I hope so. I haven't seen it yet.
Was it funny doing it?
God, comedy's hard work. It wasn't terribly fun. Well, of course it was funny doing it, because Russell's very, very funny. And also he was as funny, if not funnier, off the screen than he was on the screen, you know, just hanging out. So it was a great pleasure on that level.
Dame Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lovely to see you doing Prospero. Lovely to see you on Film Waiting.
Thank you.
Oh, release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath, gentle breath of yours, my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please.
The Tempest, starring Helen Mirren, is out on Friday, the 4th of March. And now the critical eyes of Film Weekly turn to the week's other releases. I'm joined by Zan Brooks. Zan, you made it through the Oscars. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Zan, this week we'll talk about The Adjustment Bureau. Then we'll talk about Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. And then we'll talk about Archipelago. But we'll start with The Adjustment Bureau, as I suppose this is the big Hollywood offering of the week. It stars Matt Damon and Emily Blunt in a sci-fi rom-com sort of thing with two lovers running around New York trying to escape the fates.
You're that guy running for Senate, aren't you?
I am that guy, yeah. Are you a registered New York voter?
Do I sound like I am?
David!
I gotta go. Sorry.
How was that? I don't know.
Zan, this is based on a Philip K. Dick story. I didn't know that until the final credits.
I didn't know that, but I wrote in my notes, it's like something from Philip K. Dick. But then I also wrote in my notes, it's a kind of weird mix of Bourne and actually... The director, George Gandolfini, apparently wrote some of the Bournes or something.
Oh, did he?
Was involved
I'd never
in
heard
it.
Of him. Yeah.
Also, there was a bit of Eternal Sunshine in there and a bit of Runaway Bride towards the end. So
there's
never
enough Runaway Bride in any way. I'm glad that you've referenced
that. There was almost
that.
Enough of it in this. It was sort of throwing everything into the pot.
It was a bit Manchurian Candidate.
A bit Manchurian Candidate, a little bit Inception.
Yes.
It was all secondhand ingredients thrown in with the gas turned up under it.
I must say, I didn't know anything about it because it's been
Me
the
neither.
Oscars and I went to see the adjustment.
There's been no buzz about it at all,
has there? I thought it was going to be about a sort of removal company that come in and just alter the desk a little bit.
It wasn't about that at all.
It wasn't. Might have been more interesting.
Do you know what, though?
I quite liked it. I quite liked it. It was really crap, and I really quite enjoyed it. But I have been up quite a lot of watching the Oscars.
Yeah.
But there was something sort of odd about the tone here. I mean, I say a sci-fi rom-com. It wasn't really... There was a bit of City of Angels in there. More City of Angels, the remake, than the Wim Wenders original.
Shall we try and explain it a little bit
in terms
of the plot?
Yeah. Okay.
Matt Damon plays this sort of thrusting young politician who's running for the Senate, and then arrives at work just like 10 minutes early and sees his friend and his kind of confidant being adjusted by these mysterious sort of bureaucratic angels. And then he is told, you've just seen behind a curtain you never knew existed.
Yes.
And it's really a film for schizophrenics, this film. It fulfills everything a schizophrenic thinks about the world.
But before he gets there, we see one of these angels in a hat who look like sort of extras from Mad Men. In fact, one of them is an extra from Mad Men.
The guy who plays Roger Sterling.
Yeah, and then Anthony Mackie, who was in Hurt Locker. Yeah. He's supposed to stop him 10 minutes before, so that coffee spills on his shirt. They concoct these little plans. So these are the people that are kind of actually sort of making life work for the chairman, or they refer to
for the
him.
Chairman. Yeah.
So the little cracks in society and all. Does it set up its kind of logic enough for you to kind of think, well, maybe there are these little people making life work?
It sort of does up to a point, and it's one of those films that if you stop to think about it all slightly falls apart.
Because I mean, they meet cute Emily Blunt and Matt Damon in the men's room of a kind of big hotel.
Yeah, well, we've all done that, haven't we?
Yeah. And she's sort of playing it as the kind of Rosalind Russell character. She's quite ballsy and funny and kind of smart. I like Emily Blunt. I liked her in Romeo and Juliet, I have to say.
I liked her in that. I thought her accent was a little bit wayward
I think she was all over that. I mean, I didn't know if she was supposed to be English. No one remarked on her being English or anything in this. She's a dancer as well. There's another trend going on.
She could be the one of the best dancers America has ever produced, we're told.
After Natalie Portman. It's not so bad, the Adjustment Bureau. We quite like it.
It's all right.
Almost intelligent. And there was a bit about love, because it really is about how love can overcome.
Yes, it is about how love kind of breaks the plan, really. That, and I guess if it has any message at all thrown into this pot, it's that we're only hungry when we're brokenhearted, and we only achieve our greatness if we're not satisfied in our personal life.
Yeah.
That's something we both got very much sorted. We're here, and Matt Damon is running for president.
That is the Adjustment Bureau, and for some strange reasons, Anne and I both quite like it. We hadn't slept for a couple of days. Zan, Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, also takes place in New York, like the Adjustment Bureau, but it's a documentary New York, a companion piece, in fact, to the Oscar winner Inside Job. It traces the rise and fall of the former scourge of Wall Street, Elliot Spitzer, who became governor of New York before getting embroiled in a call girl scandal that rather scuppered his own moral crusade.
We knew that folks would come down hard on us if we ever stumbled, which is why the downfall was so shocking.
When I assumed office, which was January of 1999, investment bankers were, to use Tom Wolfe's great phrase, masters of the universe.
CEOs began to take everything they could, and ultimately that was going to destroy our economy.
They literally were terrified at this guy coming after them.
The New York Times identifies Governor Spitzer's mystery call girl as Ashley Dupree.
I have acted in a way that violates my or any sense of right and wrong.
Zan, I mentioned Inside Job, the Oscar winner, which kind of looked at the kind of the CEOs and how rampant they were, and the kind of moral bankruptcy that's been going on, as well as the fiscal bankruptcy. Client 9 kind of gets a bit more into the nitty-gritty of it, focusing on New York.
Yeah, and focusing on New York, and focusing in particular on Elliot Spitzer, the former governor of New York, who was caught with his pants down and tripped up by being involved in a prostitution ring at the Emperor's Room VIP. Which, you know, is not somewhere that I've been familiar with.
You take their number down pretty sharpish. That was the note you were making, yeah.
And I guess what it is, it's a film that kind of shows you the real story behind the tabloid story. Now, I was only familiar with Elliot Spitzer as, you know, one of the typical politicians who doesn't practice what he preaches and gets caught out and is totally disgraced, and that's his career over.
Yeah, I must say, I confess, I knew about him because he was widely tipped to become the first ever Jewish president.
He was, yeah.
He was going to be there before Barack got there.
Yeah. Along the way, though, he made a lot of powerful enemies. He was the sort of self-styled sheriff of Wall Street and was basically trying to kind of clean up the whole financial system there. He made some very powerful enemies in the Republican majority leader in the New York Senate, the strategist Roger Stone. And all of these people are corralled into this film basically to gloat. And it's a very neat trick by Alex Gibney to basically expose the real reasons behind the story, behind how Elliot Spitzer was exposed to such to the degree that he was, with these people basically pulling the strings in the media behind.
Did you get a real sense of how power works in the kind of corridors and glass rooms of America? I mean, these people you mentioned, if it was in Britain, you know, it would be very Etonian kind of.
It's a rough house.
This lot are like, you know, construction workers.
Yeah, basically. This is basically we're still in kind of Boss Tweed style America here. This is the rough and tumble of New York politics. And it's impossible even to say Elliot Spitzer is the total victim of this. You know, he's a fairly rough and tumble, obnoxious, arrogant arsehole
himself.
Many
stories about him shouting at people and saying, I'm going to get yourself in a bunny bag.
He's a pugnacious alpha male who you actually think, yeah, I can believe that people would hate your guts. But there's nobody here that comes out whiter than white. Somebody, I can't remember who this was, but someone was saying this is basically like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where Mr. Smith isn't as clean as he should be and where Claude Rains wins.
Yeah, it's true, actually. I can see why it wasn't. It was widely tipped to be on the nominations for the best documentary. It was on the long list, didn't make the short list. Inside Job, which features some testimony from Elliot Spitzer in it itself, did make it in. Did you think this was a bit parochial? I mean, if you didn't know about New York politics or care about New York politics, is there any reason for you to be kind of attracted to this?
I think it probably is a bit parochial. And I think maybe another reason why it didn't make the short list is it's tangled. Inside Job did a very good job of separating all these issues out and explaining them. This is just, you're being kind of pitched into the cauldron of it all. And yes, there's a real story going on here. And yes, he was basically, it was like a kind of almost the equivalent of a gangland hit for what he was trying to do. But it's not a clear-cut story. You can't say this is an absolute whiter-than-white hero and these are the villains.
There's a suggestion that he was sort of set up.
Yeah.
But you can't really set someone up to start calling prostitutes.
You can't. And he, to his credit, he makes no bones about that. He says, you know, I brought this all on myself. It's my shame. It's all showbiz.
Isn't it just? On a very different note, and I don't think we can actually kind of connect our next film to either of the previous two, is Archipelago. It's the latest film from Joanna Hogg, whose first film, Unrelated, won the Guardian First Film Award. Her follow-up was therefore much anticipated. In a similar vein, it looks at middle-class families on holiday. Unrelated was set in Tuscany, and Archipelago is set on the Scilly Isle of Tresco.
I have no idea what I'm doing. Am I doing the right thing? I have no idea. I'm going away to Africa for 11 months. Why? Who knows?
Edward, your face is in the sun.
Sorry.
We're very used to British films looking at estates, be they council or country. It's kind of interesting to hear those middle-class voices, isn't it?
It is. I don't know why that would be. I mean, you know, Eric Rohmer gets away with it, Chabrol, you know, all of those people. There's a tradition of it in France.
Yeah,
in
Bergman
England,
gets away with it.
Yeah, in England, there's an uncomfortable quality to it. It's either you've either got to kind of stereotype them or you've got to sort of celebrate them, like Four Weddings and a Funeral or something like that. This basically just looks at them with a very clear eye. There's no moral judgment here at all.
Actually, one of the kind of chief kind of plaudits that I will give Archipelago is that I didn't hate these characters. I didn't start thinking, oh my God, they're so insufferably posh and middle class.
No, I didn't hate them at all.
No, I rather like them.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's a film about family dynamic, really, and about how your role within a family is scripted from a very early age. And then when you grow up and you go back into that dynamic, you're expected to follow that script. And if you don't, it's a real transgression.
Yeah, and we should explain that Tom Hiddleston and Lydia Leonard play Cynthia and Ed, and they're two grown-up kids who've gone back with their mum to where they used to spend their summer holidays on Tresco. They're waiting for their dad to come, but he doesn't come, and they've hired a cook for the holidays, and that's about it. A few walks
that's
and art
kind
classes.
Of about it. But basically you're watching the sort of fracture of this family, so it's all about this weird little ripple effect that can come from the smallest little transgressions within this hothouse domestic environment.
There's a brilliant scene, which could be almost a parody scene, in which they go to a restaurant, a very nice sort of hotel with a wonderful view, and they're the only people in there. They spend about 10 minutes trying to choose which table to sit at, which is very English. And then there's a terribly English scene of the daughter, Cynthia, trying to send back her underdone guinea fowl.
Yes.
This isn't done properly. That's already pink.
Really? Would you like me to get you a new one, or would you?
Can I have a word with the chef? Because that's actually quite dangerous.
I'm sure you've done the right thing.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Edward.
It is just a thumbnail.
I was thinking
of
that when I was, you know, you're saying we can't connect this film to any other films that we've been discussing this week. I think that that restaurant scene is as tense as anything you will see in The Bourne Ultimatum or The Adjustment Bureau or Un Prophet or whatever. It's absolutely, I was on the edge of my seat and was kind of sweating.
I preferred this to her first film, Unrelated.
I did.
And I think it had Bergman in there as well because of The Archipelago. And it gets better the more I talk about it. Archipelago. Would you say that's your film of the week, unless
easily.
You wanted to watch Emily Blunt in a Dress?
Easily, although let's not discount Emily Blunt in a Dress. The Adjustment Bureau. The Adjustment Bureau for your popcorn movie, this for your bit of class.
For a carrot cake. Zan, thank you very much indeed. For more of Zan's reviews and cinematic ruminations, go to the always brilliant guardian.co.uk/film. Well, a few weeks ago, I met with one half of directorial sibling team, Ethan and Joel Cohen, to talk about their Oscar-nominated version of a Western, True Grit. This week, there's another reworking of the Western concept, this time in animated form. Director Gore Verbinski is famous for making three of the Pirates of the Caribbean films, starring, of course, Johnny Depp. One of them became the third film ever to gross over $1 billion at the international box office. Well, now that duo is about to release Rango, in which Johnny Depp plays Rango, a pet chameleon who finds himself in an old West town in the middle of the Mojave Desert, surrounded by characters straight out of Western fiction. Quite a departure, then, from the large scale of the Pirates franchise. I went to meet Gore Verbinski to ask him how the idea for Rango came about.
It's something that the original concept for Rango came out of a meeting with a good friend, David Shannon, who's a children's book illustrator. We were discussing, you know, trying to do an animated movie, maybe, sort of kicking around this idea of a Western with creatures of the desert, and out of that came sort of chameleon identity crisis. We kind of brought that to Johnny and asked him if that was something he'd be interested in doing, and he was very much keen on I think he is a chameleon. So incubated that for a few years while shooting some films together, and then it was time to sort of knuckle down.
So what in between takes as Jack Sparrow, you'd kind of say to him, don't forget Rango on the back burner there?
Honestly, he just... he took a leap of faith and said, "I'd love to do it." There was no screenplay or anything.
When you said there was no screenplay, was there eventually a screenplay that you gave to Johnny Depp and to Ned Beatty, Isla Fisher, Abigail Breslin, or because Johnny's stuff in particular seems like you got him in a room, gave him a bottle of tequila and said, "Improvise, go."
Well, it's supposed to have that feeling, but all the jokes were there, all the text was there, all the artwork was there. Remember, it's a 3.5-year process. The actors are with us for 20 days.
Right.
So, we just tried to keep it alive and keep it fun and make it feel like it was occurring, not something that was conceived. You know, we tried to a sense that, you know, I've got a camera on my shoulder and there's a, 5'8" lizard talking to a tortoise and I'm photographing it as it's happening.
I thought Johnny was great to see him doing this sort of stuff. I wasn't aware of seeing. Obviously, kind of chipped in, it kind of tapped into that whole kind of dead man thing that he did. I was reminded of that on a few occasions. But not only referencing his own performances, I noticed there was a little Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas joke going on there as well. There were references to that, hundreds of other westerns. In fact, all other westerns. Was that something that you wanted to do? You wanted to pay homage to that?
Yeah, well, the film is very much a film within a film. I mean, there are these Mexican-Greek chorus singing of the legend of Rango and his ultimate demise.
The owl mariachis.
Yeah, the owls, they sort of follow him throughout the film. He's plagued by their presence. we break the fourth wall a few times. We, you know, our protagonist is a thespian and in search of an audience. He's very much aware of probably Homer and Shakespeare and certainly Sergio Leone. I think he has a good sense of the iconic hero as he as it pertains to you know, pretending to be something, and he takes on the persona of Rango because I think he's quite aware that he's entered a Western genre. So with all those sort of layers going on, it's very self-reflexive, and it seemed like it was that the film could celebrate, you know, archetypes and iconography of that genre.
In a way, it seemed to me that it's not an animation for kids as such. It's one of the first ones I've seen that you could sort of say, you can go and see this, you don't have to take a child or even your inner child with you. I think, you know, Western aficionados would like it, Johnny Depp fans would like it, fans of anarchic humor would like it.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting. I mean, we definitely, you know, people talk about animated films as if animation is a genre, and it's a technique for telling a story. You know, it's a movie, it's a story, you know, we've tried to be as irreverent as possible.
Mm-hmm. Irreverent yet completely respectful of the kind of craft that has gone into those previous Western films. I noticed you've got Roger Deakins as a cinematographical consultant. Very good credit he gets there. But I mean, you know, I think he's brilliant. Not only is he British, but he has shot some beautiful stuff for the Coens. Obviously, I'm thinking of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and the current True Grit that seems to kind of filter into yours. And I was amazed at the end, because we didn't know this before it began, that he was consulted, and it does look absolutely brilliant. It must have been the best shot looking animation I've seen.
Yeah, well, Roger came on quite early in the process. I called him because we were, you know, you're sitting with your lighting technicians on a computer, and they're lighting a scene, and then we're moving the camera to get another shot, and they're sort of made this assumption that that was the light in the room and that it wouldn't change. And in live action, we cheat constantly. We're lowering the camera, put somebody on an Apple box, move a lamp, cheat the fill light. It's you know, it's 20, 30 minute relight between every setup. So to see the techs kind of, you know, start to get a little shocked at how much work was required. And, you know, there's only so much I could do in sort of explaining to them what we would do every time we moved the camera. So it was like, Roger, help. Mm. You know, and he was always at the end of the phone. Would send him an email or a still image. And he was very responsive to, you know, well, this is what we would do if it was a real movie, because that was very important, that it feel like, again, like it was photographed, you know, that things were occurring and that we were capturing them as opposed to, you know, fabricating them.
Some of those pink sunsets and the desert moons, they're absolutely beautiful, and you could see him. I could see the Deakins in them, and they kind of recur in True Grit. There's also a couple of kind of classic Western shots. There's a bit when Rango walks into the saloon bar, and there's a shot of him through the whiskey glass or the cactus juice glass, whatever it is, that refracts, and that's a beautiful shot that's animated. You must work very hard to get shots like that. Tell me about your relationship with Johnny Depp now, because it's becoming, you know, it's kind of burgeoning. I mean, you've worked with him, you know, several times now. So the Three Pirates, then this one, is Tim Burton looking nervously over his shoulder saying, Verbinski's stealing my man?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, Johnny can do, you know, four or five films a year. It takes us two and a half years to make a movie. So, no, we've just become good friends, you know.
You said he was he's playing a chameleon here, and you think he's a chameleon. Is that how you presented it to him? You're going to play a chameleon, Johnny, because you are one.
Yeah, I think, you know, the real core is came in sort of talking to Johnny about this identity crisis. If you're all these characters, if you're Jack Sparrow, if you're Scissorhands, if you're, you know, Ed Wood, there's not a lot of room left there for Johnny Depp. And that's really, you know, that question of who is Rango and is a very complex, emotionally complex one. It requires a tremendous amount of detail in the animation to kind of see that sort of false bravado and see the little tells that one would get from a live-action performance. So, yeah, I think that's something that really that Johnny sort of, you know, keyed off of and brought to the project.
I get the sense here that he's enjoying himself immensely at recording the voice track for Rango.
Yeah, it was good fun. I mean, it's not without its challenges. I think everybody was a little shocked, although I told them many, many times. They were a little shocked when they showed up and, you know, they were required to do 10, 12 pages of dialogue a day and not read. So when you're in a movie, you're doing maybe 2 pages, 2.5 pages of dialogue a day. and you're doing two lines and going to your trailer and coming back 40 minutes later when we relight and doing 2.5 more bits of dialogue. And this is, show up in your street clothes, grab a hat, put on a sidearm, and 10, 12 pages, 5 or 6 scenes, chronologically, working our way through the film.
Does Johnny get into this as the performance? I'm sure he can't help but perform it as he's going along.
Well, that's the whole point, yeah. I mean, we want acting. We want reacting. We've got Ned Beatty and Harry Dean Stanton and Bill Nye, and, I want to see them kind of crashing into each other. And there's something honest in that moment, even if it's sort of joyous. If it's the more awkward, the better.
Yeah. I always think that when you were making these rodenty creatures, that reminded me of the Christopher Walken line about, if you want to catch the mouse, you have to think like a mouse. Mm. I'm wondering if you have spent so long drawing rodents that you now think like a mouse.
I think like a lizard right now.
He says, his eyes darting around the room and his tongue coming out of his mouth. Gore Verbinski, thanks very much. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Gore Verbinski, and his film Rango goes on nationwide release here in the UK from Friday the 4th of March. And that is all for this week. The music we've been featuring in the podcast was from the score to Rango, composed by Hans Zimmer, who's fast becoming the John Williams of his generation, isn't he? The Tempest music, incidentally, was Prospero's Coda, composed specially for the film and featuring Beth Gibbons of Portishead fame on vocals. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. My Trailer Trash column will be there as ever, as well as the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Lucy Greenwell, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.